I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. There's a little bit of change in the agenda. Senate Bill 150 has been pulled. The proponents of the bill said that there needs to be a little bit more work on it, and so we will not be hearing that bill. So therefore, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Mr. Shook, do you want to tell us what this bill does?
Madam Chair, 159 authorizes certain public officials to inspect and obtain information pertinent to investigation of chemical diseases and protects confidentiality of information obtained during an investigation.
Paul Ciesielak, and is that the only one that's going to testify for this one? Okay.
Madam Chair, at some point we need to have Katie King actually testify on a bill. Maybe not this one, but...
Thank you. And we do know that there are amendments to this bill, but they, not all the parties have been privy to them, so we will not be moving this bill today.
Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Ciesielak. I manage the Communicable Disease Program with the Oregon Public Health Division. You have my testimony. I won't read it to you. If I could just recap briefly, this bill is intended to fix what we see as three kind of minor holes in our Communicable Disease Authority, things that I hope you'll agree are common sense public health tools that are needed, and frankly, for many years, which we've sort of assumed that we had. And the reason they become an issue is largely because of the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which allows hospitals and physicians to give us certain protected health information if it's allowed by state public health statute. And as you can imagine, the hospitals and physicians are now concerned, is this information that we've typically been gathering specifically allowed by state public health statute, because or else federal HIPAA would not permit them to release it. So the areas that we're interested in are, first of all, that when a reportable disease is reported, let's say salmonellosis or meningococcal disease, we typically need to gather a bunch of information, and that information may extend beyond the case of reportable disease. So if there's a case of meningococcal disease, we may need to know who else was exposed to that person in the physician's waiting room, and we typically ask for that kind of stuff, and now we're getting a little blowback. Does HIPAA allow us to do this? And so we want it explicitly allowed in statute. The next thing is that we realize that some of our information is not protected from Public Records Act release. Information on cases of reportable disease is explicitly protected, but if we, for example, do a case control study where, you know, we want to find out were cases more likely to have eaten the peanut butter than non-cases, and we call up a bunch of people out of the phone book at random, we have their names, we have their addresses, we have a bunch of information about their food consumption habits and maybe other things, and their identities and information is not specifically protected. So we want to be able to say it was gathered in the course of a public health investigation for public health purposes. Can we protect that information as well? And then finally, regarding release of information, our statutes are pretty restrictive, appropriately so, about when we can release information, and they're restricted to two things. Number one is in the case of occupational exposure. So if a healthcare worker gets a needle stick, for example, or a policeman is wrestling with somebody who has a reportable disease, then we have ways of being able to relay information to those exposed persons that they were exposed to a disease and might need to do certain things to protect themselves. However, there are certain circumstances where we may need to release other information. For example, we know a patient was in your emergency department. You know, we're talking to a hospital. We know that a patient with measles was walking through your emergency department. And we need to be able to figure out who might have been exposed, and we may need to release the name of that person so they can figure out exactly what hours the person was there and who may have been exposed if we don't have any other way to get it. But our statutes don't, you know, particularly allow us to release that kind of information to find out who else was in the waiting room, for example. So there are just some niggling circumstances like that where we'd like authority to say if it's necessary for public health purposes, we can release it beyond, you know, occupational exposure considerations.
Dr. Cieslak, on page 3 of the bill, when you're talking about who you can release the information to, on line 30 in D, you say you can actually release it to any person if the department has reasonable cause to believe that this will prevent a clear and imminent threat. What is an example of, you've listed a lot of others, law enforcement, healthcare providers, agencies. This broadens it to you can really release it to anyone then. Could you cite an example where that would be the case?
Boy, I'm drawing a blank right now. I think we just wanted authority to be able to say, look, it doesn't fall into one of these neat categories, but if there is a clear and imminent threat, you know, can we have authority to release it? But Chair Moniz Anderson, I am drawing a blank right now about a specific circumstance.
And can you address the amendments? Because the amendments will be, they're done, do they change the bill drastically or not? Because I were wondering if we will then still need to have another public hearing on it.
Chair Moniz Anderson, we worked with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems on some amendments, and we're fine with their amendments as proposed. We have not had an opportunity to look at what has come back to us from Legislative Council, and we'd like the opportunity to do that. But as we had initially worked with Ms. Dayton, we're fine with those amendments.
Okay, and we'll just have those amendments explained to us when... Glenn, do you want to explain what the amendments actually do, or are you prepared to do that? Come up and...
And we don't have them. You have them, but we don't.
Yeah, we don't have them.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The short answer is not yet, because I haven't had a chance to see them.
Okay.
But I do appreciate the department's willingness to hear our concerns, and I anticipate these amendments will meet them, but I just need to look at them.
Okay. Great. Yes. Senator
Thank
Moore.
You, Chair. My question is with respect to federal law and state law, with respect to disclosure, the HIPAA requirements. Can we essentially preempt by state law, federal law?
Chairman, what would you like me to do? I'm general counsel for the Hospital Association, so maybe I'll take that one. Senator Morrison, Oregon cannot legally preempt the federal law, but what Oregon can do is take advantage of the HIPAA allowance or pathway for disclosures that are required by Oregon or by state law. So I know one of the issues that we, or better said, one of the pathways or remedies we sometimes seek for disclosures of information is if Oregon law requires providers and others to disclose it, then typically we can within the parameters of the requirement. The other pathway that provides that I know the state commonly uses is public health surveillance. When they're acting in their role as a public health surveillance agency, then we can disclose to them for that reason as well. So while we cannot preempt federal law gives the state some pathways to choose, and I think that's the avenue that this bill has chosen as well.
Thank you.
And just another clarification, if we have an outbreak and it's in a daycare and you need to notify all the parents, et cetera, the information you gather, though, is not public to all of the various children's parents, correct?
Chairman Moniz Anderson, that's correct. We are still not allowed to disclose the names of specific cases of illness. What we can say, for example, is and what we would say is somebody within this daycare center has such and such disease. We would like to be able to contact the parents of all the children and advise them regarding appropriate preventive measures.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for being a few minutes late. I was down at the Women's Wellness breakfast. They've got some interesting bills coming towards us, as you probably know, so I got a preview of those. I also was troubled by the same thing you were troubled by when I read through this last night and this morning. That's the piece on page 3 of Any Person. That just seems awfully broad to me, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. This is a pretty sensitive issue sometimes, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable giving a public health officer that kind of authority just to on his own authority, make a decision of giving that kind of information out. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. And I'd just like to hear a little more about what your thinking behind that was.
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Bates. Again, we wanted sort of a broader authority that in circumstances that are difficult to foresee, to go beyond the specifics of healthcare providers or law enforcement authorities or occupational exposures. I suppose we're thinking, if we're dealing with somebody on an airline, for example, and the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control call for prophylaxis of persons who are sitting around a certain seat on the airplane, could we say, yes, it was the person in seat 3A who had the disease of interest? Just other circumstances like that where we need to give some indication about who the person is, because it affects the assessment of who might have been exposed, because we're interested in getting from the airlines lists of passengers who are sitting in seats around that particular one. So I'm struggling right now to pull up more examples, but it's that sort of circumstance where we feel right now that we may not have the authority to do it.
Thank you. I'm going to think about this for a while. Yeah. Thank you.
Because in that particular instance, it is important to get that information, and if you're prevented from getting it from, say, the airlines, there will be people being exposed that could become very, very sick.
Madam.
Yes,
Chair,
Senator Morissette.
How about in a crowded theater that you've identified someone who was in that theater that had this very communicable disease and you wanted to notify those people in that area? Would that be another example of that?
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Morissette. I would think in that circumstance, because our instinct is to release to as few people as possible, we would probably try to get, if we could, we would try to get from the patient a general idea of where he was sitting. If the patient was unable to provide that information because he was too sick or whatever, we might just... I don't think the people in the theater would know who was sitting where, and so it's hard for me to imagine a benefit that would come from releasing the person's name to the theater owner. We would probably have to say, potentially everybody in the theater was exposed and go from there.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Getting back to your airline example, why couldn't you just request of the airline that you need the information without being specific as to why?
Chairman Anderson, Senator Cruz, thank you. It's possible that we could get it without releasing the identity. If, for example, the airline could promptly provide us with a list of passengers and where they were sitting, and we knew where our patient was sitting, then we could go without releasing the identity, and that's what we would do. But if, on the other hand, again, the patient was sick, we couldn't get from the patient where he was sitting, we needed to find out where he was sitting, the only people who would have that information, to my knowledge, would be the airline. And so we might have to say, you know, it was, you know, Joe Slobotnik. Can you tell us what seat he was sitting in? And we'll go from there.
I guess, Madam Chair, just, you know, back to what Senator Bates was talking about is how much do we disclose and when. Senator Morissette's example, there's no way in the world you could make a determination of who was even in the movie, let alone where they sat. But I would think if you were to call United and say, we have a concern on flight 57, could you give us a manifest? And then you would have all the information you need without having to disclose actually anything other than you had a concern. So,
right, Senator Cruz, if we knew where the patient was sitting and we could get the manifest that had the names and seats of everybody else, then we wouldn't need to disclose any information, and we wouldn't.
Right.
But if it's the circumstance where we couldn't get from the patient where he was sitting, then I think we would have to ask the airline, where was this guy sitting?
Okay, I suppose if you're going Southwest, there's no assigned seating. But United, there is.
We'll slip you next door to Typhoid Mary. You'll have a good time.
Okay. All right, any further discussion? Thank you. We will be waiting for everyone to look at the amendments. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 159 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 160. And Mr. Shook, do you want to tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 160 requires the Department of Human Services to adopt procedures for authorizing HIV tests of individuals in certain state institutions who are incapable of granting informed consent.
Okay. Let's start with... is there any particular order that we need to go on with these?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Unless you just start with Mary.
Okay, let's start with Bob Jundev, Melissa Unger, and Mary Botkin.
Has Peter said okay, or do you know yet?
Well, I guess Donald Saint was from the Oregon State. Let's have Dr. Saint come up to introduce. There you are.
I'm calling the same people down there.
Okay, we'll check first.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance. I'm the Governmental Affairs Manager for Addictions and Mental Health Division, which the Oregon State Hospital is a part of. I just wanted to introduce to you Dr. St. Justin to talk about briefly. He will go through the bill. I wanted to let you know that we are waiting for -1 amendments to come forward that takes care of a little bit of a problem in the bill. If you look on page 2 of the bill, line 4, the Department of Human Services shall prescribe by rule of procedure whereby an individual incapable of granting informed consent for an HIV test may be tested. We are adding an amendment to that to specify that these are individuals at the state institutions that are defined later in the bill. This is very specific to individuals at the state hospital and the Blue Mountain Recovery Center and the Eastern Oregon Training Center. So I just thought I would jump in and say that very quickly before I turn it over to Dr. St. Just.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Donald St. Just. I am the supervising physician of the Informed Consent Department at Oregon State Hospital, and I am pleased to be here and grateful to be here today, Madam Chair, members of the committee, to be able to speak in support of Senate Bill 160, which I believe, and doctors at the state hospital believe, is very important to cure a problem that has arisen legally with regard to testing people for HIV, only those folk who do not have the capacity to give informed consent. Historically, the state hospital has tested those people for HIV who do not have the ability to give informed consent under an old mechanism involving outside consultants and so forth. A little bit more than a year ago, the state hospital and other persons involved in the mental health care system devised a new system which allows administrative law judges to make decisions as to capacity to give informed consent. Under that new system that we have, though, the judges are not permitted to make decisions with regard to HIV testing, as such are considered routine procedures. And the judges are not allowed to make decisions as to routine procedures. Well, in 2005, the Centers of Disease Control have proclaimed that HIV testing is a routine procedure. So we essentially have a catch-22. And that is also due to the fact that the old Oregon statutes require informed consent. I know this is maybe a little bit confusing. It's confusing to a lot of people, but anyway, we're in a catch-22 where we really need the legislature to allow DHS to allow the administrative law judges to make a determination as to capacity for those who cannot give informed consent. And so Senate Bill 160 would allow this new administrative procedure to address the issue of testing for HIV under that procedure. It in no way involves persons who have capacity and can give consent. They will still be allowed to decide whether they want to be tested or not. It only addresses those persons who do not have the capacity. For example, the state hospital has had difficulties testing some persons who are demented, can't talk, obviously can't give informed consent. So they come to the hospital and there is no mechanism for testing them. We frequently get people who, for one reason or another, are so psychotic they can't talk about anything. They can't meaningfully discuss anything, and there is no mechanism for us to be able to test them. Historically, we always have had a mechanism. Now we don't, so we have not been able to test for the last few months. It is critical that we be allowed to test people so that they can receive treatment. It's critical. In the early days when the Oregon legislature passed, rightfully so, safeguards requiring informed consent, we did have a mechanism. Now we don't. So we need to be able to test for the health and well-being of patients infected with HIV and for the community as well. There have been tremendously good developments in treatment for HIV. Tremendously good developments. We can now prolong the lives of persons almost indefinitely, such as Magic Johnson, who is healthy and alive after many, 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 many years. In fact, we can almost get the viral load down to nothing. So treatment is very, very important. And at the state hospital, we've had some people who, with treatment, have had their viral load reduced to almost nothing, and they're still around after 10 years and doing quite well. But if we can't test, we can't get that early treatment for them. And that's
Dr.
critical.
St. Jess, what tests, routine tests, can you give without informed consent? Hep B, Hep C, can you test for those without informed consent?
We can, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I agree with you that it can now be considered a routine. I mean, CDC did say it was a routine test. But back in the 80s, and I remember when we started getting our first HIV patients, that was a huge issue. In fact, there were public health nurses that were refusing to visit. And I remember working for Multnomah County, there were only two of us nurses that were willing to actually go in and treat and see and work with the HIV patients. So there was a great fear back in the mid-80s, and things have really, really changed regarding that. Is there any questions?
Follow up on your question, if I could. This obviously is for HIV, but are you restricted in any other way as far as testing and treating patients at the hospital? Do you have other restrictions on you that you feel are unnecessary and are a danger to your patients, or is this the only one?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the HIV testing is the critical issue now. I do not know of any other tests that we are unable to perform at this time.
Tuberculosis?
That's what I'm thinking. Tuberculin testing and sexually transmitted diseases, hepatitis B, C, all the things we think about that are communicable and a danger to the patient and danger to the staff. Are you sure? If we're going to fix this, let's do it one time if we possibly can. So I would ask you to be thinking broadly here if possible.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I greatly appreciate your concern, and it's nice to hear that concern. I'm glad that you understand the burdens that we in the medical profession have. Fortunately, at this time, we are able to test for hepatitis B, C, A, and also the rules that we have now allow for testing for tuberculosis as a routine procedure. So I cannot think of any other test. The HIV has been problematic because, as Chairman Monis Anderson said, it had almost a special status in the mid-80s, early 80s, when there was so much fear and concern and uncertainty about the disease. It has occupied a unique place in medical law, and that's the one that is problematic today. The other tests are considered routine and are provided for in the rules, so I think we're all right on the other tests at this point.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, if I could follow up. We actually did review the possibility of needing to expand this beyond HIV, but it is particular to the statute in ORS 433 that is the problem. The rest are considered routine, and we can use either for individuals that can't give informed consent, we can use that process, or if they're considered routine, we can perform those tests.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very, very much, and thank you for the work that you do. We appreciate it. All right.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Let's call Melissa Unger, Bob Jundeff, and Mary Botkin. I don't have, and then Paul Cosgrove, but I don't have anyone else's name on the list.
Oh.
Who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, I'm Joe Thurman.
I'll put you on the list.
I represent the registered nurses at Oregon State Hospital, and we're in support of this bill. My esteemed colleague, Dr. St. Just, I think, hit it right on the head. This has been an ongoing problem for years, and it stems back to the 80s when there was when you were speaking about the stigmatism within the 80s, that brought back a lot of memories. We've hopefully moved beyond that at this point, and staff need and patients need this information so that we can adequately treat it within the healthcare system at the state hospital. We oftentimes get patients, I'm sure as you know, that are unable for whatever reason, mental illness generally, not to be able to give informed consent. And it could greatly hinder their ability to effectively get treatment. And a lot of times at the state hospital, you're dealing with bodily fluids and bloods and different things, and you need to know that.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Mary Botkin with Oregon AFSCME for the record, and we are here in support of Senate Bill 160. We think that the narrowing that will be created with the amendment and focus on the state hospital makes a lot of sense, and we're okay with that. And then I just want to remind the committee, I know that Dr. Bates and you, Madam Chair, both know that MRSA is actually killing more people today than AIDS. And so, if if that is considered to be a standard test, then AIDS should be as well. You know, there are things out there that we all need to be protected from and that our clients need to be treated for. And AIDS is probably one of the better treatable diseases now. So it'll be a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeth. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. We are in support of the bill as amended, as reported to you in the original bill. It seemed quite broad to us, and we understand that it's really designed to deal with the situation at the hospital. As you'll hear a little bit later, our office represents patients in the hearings in which there's a determination made whether they can give consent or not give consent to procedures, and we feel that this is a proper mechanism in order to make these decisions, and really it's probably only required because of that one section of state law that gives special status to HIV. Otherwise, this wouldn't be a problem that you'd have to deal with. So I think it's, as amended, it will do what needs to be done, keep patients safe, keep the facility safe, and we support that.
So as the bill is now, it would just remove an HIV test, wouldn't have the status that it has. And the amendment is going to narrow it so that it would just be considered a routine test at the Oregon State Hospital.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, right now the bill as it stands would give the Department of Human Services the authority to make decisions about any person in the state of Oregon who might not have capacity to give consent for the test. And as I understand, the amendment would narrow it just to people who live in state psychiatric hospitals. Jane Ellen.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Jane Ellen Whitehance again for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Department of Human Services. The amendment specifically allows us to use our significant medical procedure process. So it still would not be a routine process. We would be going before an administrative law judge who would determine if the individual could give informed consent or not. That way we're protecting the individual's rights. If the person decides not, if they have the capacity and decide not to have the test, that's their right to do that. But if they cannot give informed consent, an administrative law judge would make that decision. But Bob Jundeth is right, is that what we're doing is narrowing this just to the facilities, and we're not giving DHS the rule authority to test all individuals across the state of Oregon for HIV who are incapable of giving informed consent. It's very narrow to the facilities, and I just got the DASH amendment, so let me pass them out if that's okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes. You're thinking like I'm thinking.
I'm thinking a lot of different things here. One, we're going to be having, hopefully, multiple 16-bed or smaller facilities across the state. Some of the people there might be in a position they couldn't give informed consent. They'll be, they might be forensic patients. They might not be. There's still a danger to the people working there and a danger to the people involved. I'm not sure that restriction's quite what we want. Might be a first good step, maybe something we should come back and look at in the next session, but I'm just concerned about the workers and the individuals. Brings up all kinds of questions in my mind about people in our prison systems, other places, nursing homes. There's a lot of issues here. Probably should restrict it at this time, but it's a question that we should be asking ourselves as we go along. I mean, for tuberculin testing, we don't even think about that anymore. We automatically do it. And this particular disease carries a stigma with it that makes it sort of special, but it's needed to be treated early and thoroughly. We don't want a reservoir infection in our communities. I think this is a really ethical, difficult question. Restricting it probably to these two facilities right now is probably appropriate, but it raises some thoughts and questions in our minds.
I agree. I think we're being a little draconian in wanting to still keep this test at a separate status. When we are testing for syphilis, we still test for gonorrhea, we test for chlamydia, all of those specific sexually transmitted diseases, and yet this, because it had the stigma of being a gay disease, which it is not now, that is the main reason why this has had the status that it's had. So I'm very concerned that we don't. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I guess I'm just curious as to, because the amendment says housed in a state institution, which is broader than just these two facilities, is it not?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if you look in this particular statute in the bill, state institution is defined as a subset, so it includes the state hospitals, both campuses, Blue Mountain Recovery Center, and the Eastern Oregon Training Center. So there, it's not the broader state institutions that are defined in statute in ORS 179, which would include the Department of Corrections. This was particular to the process we go through for individuals at the state hospital with a significant medical procedure and the process we've established to be able to determine people's ability to give informed consent.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess back to Senator Bates's point. And you're talking the future because those things don't exist at this point in time, but at least we would know where to go to amend, wouldn't we?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a very interesting and concerning topic you've opened up here, and I guess I had made some assumptions about the prison systems and other places. I mean, I commonly admit people to nursing homes. We have to have specific testing before they go in, and I've made some assumptions about what's going on, and those assumptions are obviously wrong. I think it's something we need to think about and talk about. And we have to be handled very carefully. There's a nature not only to the individuals involved and to the people who care for them or are the guards. There's another concern that we're developing potentially a reservoir of infection, mm-hmm. which is a danger to the population as a whole, because many of these people obviously, hopefully, are reintegrated into our society. If they've been in a situation where they're more likely to pick up one of these infections, whether it be MRSA or Hep C or any of these, they're actually dangerous to the population as a whole, too, and it's a topic we probably should look at and think about.
Well, let's just look at Africa and what a terrible outbreak there is there, and that is so unacceptable. If we are narrowing the testing that we can do here in the United States, I mean, as Dr. Bates was saying, we are developing the potential of having a reservoir of HIV here in the United States. So,
Madam Chair, if I could just comment, I think that Senator Bates' comments are well taken, but I believe that we're into the area of surrogate medical decision making in a more general fashion, because there are many people who don't have the capacity to make medical decisions who are served in the mental health system and the developmental disabilities system and the senior and disabled system, many in residential facilities and many in the community. And there are mechanisms that are in place for making surrogate medical decisions, and they tend to be a little bit siloed amongst those agencies. And so I think if we were going to have a broader conversation about this, which is certainly appropriate, that we should get people from those various agencies in, just so we understand how they're dealing with those decisions now when there is not a guardian or other legal surrogate that's been designated. Treat HIV, as you noted, HIV does have this particular special status, but really it's part of an overall medical surrogate medical decision making process. It should be looked at it in the whole. And I guess so. I'm suggesting that you move ahead with this particular bill, but then we take a broader look in getting all the agencies together to look at the broader question.
Since this is the only, though, routine test that you have to get informed consent for, I don't see how that affects the broader context, that we're just taking this particular blood test that already CDC has said is a routine test regarding those other issues. I'm not sure what you're referring to, but I don't see how that would necessarily impact just this particular one test.
Madam Chair, I wasn't suggesting. Well, let me put it this way. There is a special law about HIV testing, which is why the state hospital is needing this particular amendment to statute. But how that particular test is handled in our other service systems, and how general surrogate decision making, having somebody else make decisions for someone who doesn't have capacity, how that's handled in other areas, I believe is different depending upon the area of service. And it would be good to hear from DHS folks who work in those other areas to understand how they do it now and whether they need additional changes in order to effectuate HIV testing or any other type of testing.
Senator Moines and members of the committee, I think personally that it should be a part of the initial group of testing that's automatically done when people come into the hospital. Although I agree with Mr. Jundup, I think in certain situations in the community it should be looked at differently depending on the situation. If someone is in a healthcare facility that maybe is a small home out there, do they have the capacity to make those decisions? Absolutely, I think they should be allowed those. In our situation, it is different. People are committed to the state hospital sometimes for years, and we have a potential for an outbreak that could be catastrophic in certain cases. Now, that's never happened, luckily, but it could, because we do not have it. And we're putting that up to a trial judge to make that decision. I think that should be left to the medical community to make that decision.
Madam Chair, we've stumbled into a fairly large area. At the same time, I don't want to derail this legislation, but because I think this is a tool that the state hospital needs. So, let's make sure this one's, let's not derail something good in the attempt to do something fabulous.
Not throughout the perfect, good for the perfect.
Yeah.
Any other discussions?
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I think you've opened up a conversation on something that cries out for a work group in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things start popping into your head here. I would require, as an example, HIV testing in all pregnant women to protect the unborn child, because you can treat during pregnancy now and prevent the child from becoming HIV positive. And there's some privacy issues there, and all kinds of stuff go on. And so probably it's something we should be looking at in the interim.
Yeah, I mean, it goes into the struggles we've had for Hep C testing, and there's a whole lot of issues that roll into this. So, right?
Let's not get. I think we have to deal with this one and not get bogged down.
Yes.
Okay.
Good idea.
All right. With that, any further discussion? We are not going to be moving the bill. We have Paul Cosgrove yet to testify, and Melissa, do you want to also testify? And the amendments just came out. We need to look at that. But
thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'll make this quick. I just want to add my voice to this in support of this bill. I represent the SEIU Local 503, and we represent 900 frontline workers at the Oregon State Hospital. And we believe that this bill is exactly what you've all said, really important for patient safety, but also staff safety at the Oregon State Hospital. And I'm glad to hear all of your comments of support, because we believe it's an important bill. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Cascade AIDS Project. Cascade AIDS Project is the state's largest AIDS service organization, and as such, we have an intimate interest in all the matters affecting people who are affected or infected with HIV or AIDS. We support the bill as amended, and we wanted to make sure that this special DHS procedure, and that's what we're talking about here, kicking this into a special DHS procedure, only affected those people who were in DHS facilities, institutions, as residents. To give you a sense that some of the other issues that you've discussed here may in fact have not be as big a problem as you assume, the issue with HIV testing is informed consent, and then of course we have the problem there are a number of people in a number of different situations who are incapable of giving informed consent. Many of those people are elderly or disabled. They're not in any institution, or at least any DHS state institution, and they have needs for somebody to give informed consent for every medical procedure that they encounter, and in fact many of them are handled under the regular guardianship statutes. So there are a whole group of people who need help giving consent for everything that happens to them in the healthcare system, and many of them, as I say, are handled under the guardianship procedure, and that's the procedure we've had for years in Oregon, and that's the one that's commonly used. The second group of people that's mentioned, the prison population, I've actually dealt with the director, Max Williams, not on his authority to do testing, because in fact he's never had any concern about his authority to do testing. In prison systems, people don't have to give consent and aren't asked for their consent on a whole lot of issues, and I believe that in fact he has that problem solved. What we've been dealing with him is in making sure there's adequate treatment, both as people enter the institution and as they leave the institution. But I've never heard that there is a problem there. If there is, I think that's a fair question to be brought back to you for further discussion. But I think that, in fact, this problem is very specifically a problem with DHS institutional residents, which this bill is directed at and focuses on and I think solves appropriately. If there are others, we will certainly want to bring them back. But I'm not sure there's a global problem with the special requirements for consent for HIV testing, because often those people who can't give consent need a guardian to give consent for their hospitalization, their institutionalization in a nursing home. All of those functions need somebody else to give consent for, and they have a guardian to do that. And that guardian can give consent for the HIV test, just like they can give consent for every other procedure. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd like to have, and I'm not sure who in the audience could answer this. I know I went and drew blood at Clackamas County Jail for inmates that came in, and we always had to get a consent from them before we could draw their blood, but this was back in the 90s, and is that what is still happening now? They have to give consent when they're in jail, and many of and we did have positives. We did have positives coming out, and again, this is a stigma. So,
Madam Chair, I can only respond that in the state correctional institutions with whom I have had some experience, and of course Ms. Botkin has some experience too, they have significant comprehensive testing for HIV and any other known infectious disease. They've never had any concern about getting consent for the people going in state institutions. Whether that also is true in county jails, I don't know. That's a good question, but I just don't know. In state institutions, I believe the problem is handled.
Madam Chair, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, Paul Cosgrove, who I have an immense amount of respect for.
Am I wrong?
Yeah.
It's always nice to
be wrong. He might be in error, and I would never say he was wrong in public on the record, but I think he may be misinformed. My understanding is that when we started doing all of the DNA testing as required by law, when we break an inmate's skin on purpose, we do need to have some level of informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a level that even when they're incarcerated, individuals in America and in Oregon still have some level of constitutional rights. And that's one of them. Now, can we compel them? Yes. Is it easier? Yes. But we can't just forcefully take things away, bodily fluids from them.
Madam Chair, I appreciate my esteemed colleague. She was very kind to me, pointing out that I might be misinformed. What I do know is that Director Williams has a comprehensive system to deal with this issue. We might want to bring him back in and have him describe the details of what he has to do and what procedures he and his department goes through in order to do it. But I do,
and I would agree that that would be appropriate.
I do know that there is a comprehensive system in the state correctional institution for testing everyone.
Madam Chair, before we continue this conversation, go on forever. I really think he calls out for interim work. I mean, two names I wrote down real quick were Dr. Mel Cohen. What's our epidemic look like? Where's the epicenters for it? Where's it coming from? Where's it going? Yeah. And the other name I wrote down was Max Williams. And we want to look at our high-risk populations, both for their protection of the workers, and, as I said earlier, protection of the general public. I don't think we've got time this morning to deal with this unless you guys are really ready to go here. We'll be here for a while, I think. But it's something we should be looking at. I agree.
And there may be special, I'm sorry, with all due respect, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think there may be some special needs and some special challenges at the state hospital. And, you know, while we need to look at this broader issue of exposure and contagion and how we handle it, because within the state prison system, once you have diagnosed something, you have an obligation to treat. And so, you know, there are special challenges, and I think that the, you know, some parts of state government and local government have challenges that are different than we have at the state hospital. And it may be that we want to take care of this very narrow piece, but also look at the bigger piece. So, anyway.
Right.
I have nothing else to offer.
I mean, people now with AIDS can live. I mean, you know, they live. And to avoid communicating this to others. We took care of the baby, the pregnant woman, and the baby, so that they can be taken care of. But we have to look at the broader population. That's what we have to look at. All right. The amendments just came out. They will be given to the various people, and we will then get them here, and we will be bringing this bill back.
And I just wanted to say, I've already reviewed the amendment. It is appropriate from our perspective, so we'd support the bill as amended with the dash
ones. Okay. And we will need to get a fiscal also.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I'll close, unless there's further discussion, Senate Bill 160, and then we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 288.
Madam Chair, at the request of Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary, Senate Bill 288 authorizes individual with mental illness who is committed to the Department of Human Services to be represented by specific persons in contested case hearing with respect to potentially unusual or hazardous treatment.
Well, it looks like the only person we have on the witness registration is Bob Jindiff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Jindiff from Disability Rights Oregon. And let me walk you through the purpose of this bill. And it touches upon the process at the state hospitals for determining informed consent or lack of ability to provide informed consent for medications and other significant procedures. There are many different avenues for people to get into the state hospital. They can be civilly committed. They can be committed by a criminal court after using the insanity defense or being found unable to proceed with a criminal charge. They can be placed by a guardian. And in all of these cases, the very fact of that placement does not give the hospital the right to medicate a person without having their informed consent. As you might expect, many people who come into the hospital may lack that ability to give informed consent, and that means that they are unable to take in information, reasonably evaluate it, and then give a reasoned decision as to whether they want medication or don't want medication. For those people, there is a process that exists in order to determine whether, in fact, they have the ability to make decisions. And if they don't have the ability to make decisions, that
that the treatment is an appropriate course of action. And that process right now, the hospital involves an administrative law hearing that is conducted in front of an administrative law judge. And what happens is that the treating physician will give notice that the physician wants to medicate an individual and that the physician believes that that person doesn't have the mental ability to make medical decisions. And so the hospital needs to have the authority to move ahead without that person's consent. Presently, that hearing in front of an administrative law judge involves the administrative law judge and then a representative of the state who gives the case of showing that the person lacks the ability to make decisions. The patient is entitled to have representation in that hearing, and at the present time, Disability Rights Oregon has a contract with Oregon State Hospital to provide that representation at the hearing. After a hearing, administrative law judge makes a decision, renders the decision, which will either be that the hospital can proceed to medicate or perform another significant procedure, as they're called. And as we recently talked about, upon passage of, if we pass the bill that you formerly were looking at, that HIV would be included in those significant procedures. The administrative law judge can also determine that that person actually does have the ability to make decisions for themselves, in which case the hospital cannot proceed against the person's will. That's the process that we have in place right now. The patient also has the right to appeal a decision if they choose to a court. Because the hearings are performed in front of an administrative judge, there is state law requires that the parties are represented by an attorney, so that there is a requirement that the patient is must have an attorney representing the patient. There is another statute that exists that allows an exception in administrative hearings, in certain types of administrative hearings, in which the state law allows a individual who is under the supervision the public interest lawyer to perform that representation, and those are and what we're attempting to do through this bill is to provide permission for legal aid organizations in our organization to provide representation for patients using a paralegal who's been trained to do the hearings and is under the supervision of an attorney. And the purpose of doing that is to give our organization the flexibility and in order to use both attorneys and non-attorneys to fill that role as needed. In our estimation, we can do that effectively using trained paralegals. We may choose not to or choose to do so. It's really a matter of the timing of the situation and who is available. And just to give you a little bit more information, the way that it works on the ground is that our office is notified generally a day or two before the hearing is scheduled. And so we must respond quickly, get our attorney down to the hospital, confer with the patient, review materials so that the patient can present his or her case at the hearing generally the next day. So it's a very fast process. And it's designed to be fast so that a patient who needs medication, who's unable to give consent to take the medication, that steps can be taken quickly in order to get them necessary care.
Mr. Jundiff, do we have a definition of what is unusual and hazardous treatment?
Madam Chair, that is spelled out in administrative rule. At present, I don't have that rule with me, but generally it's used to refer to the use of psychotropic medication with a patient. It could be...
That is considered hazardous treatment?
It's considered to be a hazardous treatment. There are special constitutional rights that attach to the forcible use of psychiatric medication. And the decisions have basically said that requiring a person to take medications that effectively change the way that they think is highly intrusive, much more so than the fact of merely taking the person's freedom away. Any scheme in which a person is forcibly placed in a treatment facility by the government, which is what happens through the civil commitment or the criminal commitment process, a person's freedom is taken away, and the due process they're entitled to beforehand happens either in the civil commitment court or in the criminal court, where decisions are made as to whether that person's freedom needs to be taken away. But then that person has an additional right, which is not to have powerful medications administered to them without some type of process.
So a psychotic person who is psychotic, who refuses medication, can refuse that because he does not want to have it.
Madam Chair, any adult or child over 15 years of age can refuse to take medication. That's part of our basic set of human rights. And the question then becomes, if the government wants to do that, which is, of course, is there, when can the government override a person's natural right not to be injected with or administered one of these medications? And that's why a process exists.
But if a psychotic person is harmful to himself or harmful to others, is that the situation in which a medication can be given that person?
Madam Chair, there is a second exception. There is an exception in which a person can be medicated if there is an emergency situation. So, as a general matter, if there's an individual who is psychotic who at that moment in time is acting violently, either a risk to others or self-harming, the treating physician has the authority to medicate for a period of time to resolve that particular emergency. But for longer term types of medication, in order to have the authority to do that, the physician will need informed consent from the individual, or what we would call substitute consent if the person is unable to give consent. And in order to gain the authority to medicate, when the person can't consent, they would have to look to some other authority. And that will generally be provided either through guardian, if there is a guardian that's been appointed by a court, or through a medication override process, whereby the doctor is given authority to do so because there's a finding that the patient can't give consent.
As you know, this is an extremely complicated area. And sometimes, especially when a person is psychotic and his thinking is very, very different and is actually harmful to himself, but he doesn't realize it's harmful to himself. And when you're psychotic, I firmly believe, although I don't know if there's evidence, that there is actual damage being done to those neurons in his brain. But that person doesn't know that. So it's actually going to be making him worse off unless he can stop that constant firing of those neurons in his brain. So I feel it's very, very complicated issue, and you can't really educate a person who's psychotic until they're not in a psychotic state. And even then, when they're not in a psychotic state, it's very difficult to for them to know what they were like in the psychotic state because they don't remember it. They don't. So very, I think it's very gray area, very complicated area. And yes, I do believe in rights, absolutely. But you also want the best outcome for the person. And I know some of those who are psychotic think the best outcome is to stay psychotic. So, yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you for that. I'd like to just comment, since our office does do many of these cases and has seen many of these situations over time, is that certainly you can draw generalities, but each case is individual in nature. And actually, part of this process, which I think has been very beneficial, has been that it encourages more communication between treaters and patients. And I think, I'm not a physician, but as I understand the literature in this area, if a physician and a patient are able to create a therapeutic alliance such that the patient understands the importance and need for medications and is willing to move ahead and do that and give consent, that's generally more beneficial than being in a situation where the person feels that they're being forced into something. There are situations where that's absolutely necessary, but oftentimes one can achieve better outcomes by encouraging more communication between the patient and the physician. Unfortunately, in our state hospital, given the highly crowded, understaffed nature of it, that it's very hard to have that communication, given the volume. And we feel that having a process in place whereby that's encouraged has been very good. I do not. What I would say to you is, I don't believe that there are people going, or very few people going unmedicated, because the person retains their rights as an adult to have control over their body. But having this process in place allows that medication to go forward in appropriate cases, and we think is a good thing. What we would like to be able to do through this bill is merely to make that process work more efficiently.
Chair.
Yes.
Let me get off a comment. I don't know if it's going to clarify things at all or maybe make things worse, but I'll try to make things clear. When you're dealing with a patient who's mentally ill, whether it's anxiety, depression, or a psychosis, you usually have several options of treatments available to them as far as counseling and medications. And when you talk about those medications with someone who's not psychotic, you can go over the side effects of those. And some of those side effects are pretty significant. It can be somnolence, can be sleepiness, can be massive weight gains. Some are associated with developing diabetes and other diseases. And you have a discussion with the patient and you give it a trial. And quite often you find that particular patient has a side effect of that drug you didn't expect, and you try something else. And so it is, to a certain degree, truly the art of medicine and not the absolute science of these issues. The problem with someone who's psychotic is you can't have that conversation. And that's the problem. You can't have that conversation. And so you have to have a surrogate way of doing this. And the way you've set up to do it is probably is about as effective as you can be. And what you're trying to do is make that a little more effective, a little quicker, because you can't get somebody in there every time to go in front of that judge and talk over these medications in that particular case and what the physician wants to do as quickly as you'd like sometimes. So I think you're both headed the same way here. The good chair wants to make sure that psychotic patient gets the best possible treatment, and you want to expedite it as much as you can also, knowing that that conversation that normally occurs between a patient and a doctor just can't occur in this situation. And damage is continuing to be done when people go into longer and longer psychotic episodes. The longer they go on, the worse they get. So you want to bring them under control quickly and early if you possibly can. So I think what you're trying to do with this bill is set up a expedited system for this, if I understand it. being able to use other people in that position to go in front of that court and make the decision quickly and get treatment to the patient. As you also know, and from my reading of the ORSs here, just to be clear, this excludes lobotomies and surgical procedures on patients, but it includes convulsive therapy, which is still being used, and in some rare cases is extremely effective. And obviously the side effects of those are pretty significant. First 3 or 4 weeks after convulsive therapy, there is a really altered state for that person, but sometimes that's all you can use, and it actually is effective. So I think I'm okay with this one. I think you're trying to improve the system. I think I understand what you're trying to do, and correct me if I'm wrong about what I've said.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, you're absolutely correct. Our interest as advocates for patients in the hospital is that they get adequate treatment, excellent treatment if possible. And this process exists in order to assure that happens, but that it happens in a manner that is respectful of people's rights. And we are of the opinion that respecting people's rights is good for everyone in the long run. And we just want to make it work more efficiently.
Madam Chair, I got to offer one more thing. I'm still a little concerned by the language. I think leads us in the wrong direction, unusual or hazardous treatment. Mm-hmm. What we're dealing with here is not unusual. It may be hazardous, as all treatments are, but I think it's probably the routine treatment. So I'm not sure quite where this unusual or hazardous. I mean, that's kind of raising the hairs in the back of my neck when I was reading this last time, going, what's unusual? What are you guys talking about here? Why was that particular language used?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that language is used because that is the language that exists in ORS 426-385, which
I saw that here.
Mm-hmm. Which describes a patient's right not to to be subjected to or to receive certain types of treatment without informed consent. Yeah. And so that is the way that the state statute is chosen to characterize those forms of treatment. And they, as you were correct in noting, that they normally refer to neuroleptic medications, shock treatment, and other types of treatments that bear significant risk, like an operation, for example. So the framers of ORS 426-385 chose to use this phrase so that it encompassed the number of types of procedures, and this is the wording that they used.
I'm going to think about this one, too. Madam Chair, I looked that up just now because I was surprised by the language. Found it there, and this makes me think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because the very next paragraph after this says you can't do operative procedures. So obviously they're talking about, lobotomies. I'm not sure this language is up to date anymore. I think it's a language for the 1950s and 60s when some terrible things were being done. And I'm not certain that's the language we should be using in this statute. And if we did change the language, we might all feel a lot better about it. So I'm going to think about that, if I could, Madam Chair.
Another interruption.
No. This might be a simple amendment that would make this a little clearer to people what we're talking about. But let me think about it.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing these forwards. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 288, and we are adjourned.